Hey, Rachel.
Hey, Ryan.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
No.
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 No. I'm going to give a 5-minute no monologue for it to slowly transition into a yes monologue. That's how I'm doing, Rachel. How are you doing?
Confused.
Well, talking about being confused, we're the Yum Yum Podcast, likingly, because we are named after the iconic line of dialogue. And why are we confused? Because we're talking about Star Trek Discovery week to week to week, episode by episode by episode. That is why we're confused, because this show, like Yum Yum, is playing four-dimensional chess while we're playing battleships. You know, like, it's on another level. It's on another plane. It's very nuanced stuff. And we're at the end of season one, I do believe. Near the final episode. It is the final episode. I don't know. They might pull another one out and be like, ha ha.
I want you first to guess, what do you think the rating for this episode is on IMDb?
7.2.
No, just an even 7.
It's a low-rated episode for the season overall.
It is. So, this is episode 15 of season one. Entitled, Will You Take My Hand?
Will you? Will you take it?
I don't want to touch Discovery's hand.
Will you take my hand, though?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's what the question is. I'm glad it's answered.
Yeah. So the synopsis that is offered up is, when the Federation seeks to turn the war with the Klingons, a dark plan is put into motion, and Captain Philippa Georgiou is tasked with its implementation. Ooh. Meanwhile, Michael Burnham is confronted with her past, and thus finds a way to try and end the hostilities.
Oh, hostilities, not the war. Okay.
No, they already said the war, so they can't use that again.
So, this was the final episode of season one. Before we launch into our thoughts on the episode on this rewatch, because that's the format, this is our first time rewatching it, I want to just preface it by saying I did not like this episode on the first watch. I found it very lackluster and a bit of a whimper of an ending to what was considered by itself and by even us as more of an explosive, action-packed, war-orientated show, that this final episode kind of felt like a wet fart and left very little of an impression. And having now rewatched it, I can say that I had forgotten 95% of what went on in this episode. It was as if I was watching it again for the first ever time in my life. It wasn't as if with the previous episodes I remembered the Blue Planet episode or the Lethe episode, the episodes that we have considered boring. There were elements to those that I had remembered. This one, I guess the rewatch has shown that it was an even bigger letdown of an ending than the first time when I saw it. How did you feel about it when you first saw this episode?
When I first saw it, I also thought that it was a whimper, and I was very frustrated with it because it wants to have it both ways, it feels like. It feels like it wants to be Star Trek, and it's pulling on those principles and saying that, like, this is what we are, while also being nothing like what Star Trek aesthetically or the experience is, or actually implementing the values that they are hearkening back to.
Well, that's how you felt the first time.
Yeah.
This time it might be a bit different because they do try with many monologues, the no, 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 yes monologue in particular, to try and hearken back to those principles of Starfleet. But what about it that first time made it feel like such a whimper of an ending?
I think part of it is because it is, in essence, an anti-climax, because we're expecting a big flourish, a big battle. That is what it's set up to be, that this is the end of the war.
Yeah.
And
what
we get is a semi-awkward scene with Giorgio and Burnham, and then like 10 minutes of wrapping up different things, and then
we get a
speech from Michael, and then
telling us the theme of the season,
and then telling us where the next season is going to go, and then we get a scene on the ship that in a way it feels like it is meant to be a cliffhanger of sorts, but it also just makes me go, well,
it's a fish hook. It's a fish hook. They're dangling the lure in front of us for next season, so we'll bite onto it and be hooked for next time. Not even a cliffhanger, it's just a lure.
Yeah.
Ooh. The Enterprise. Ooh, I know that.
Yeah, it's,
I remember that.
It's setting up by an idea, but nothing concrete. It's just like we're getting a distress signal, and they figure out that it's from the Enterprise, and we get a look between Michael and Sarek being like, oh, wait, we know that shit.
We know Pike, because the audience knows of him, because he's beep, beep, beep guy. But I think one of the things that I remember what made this such a lackluster episode is, it's not so much it's not the issue that it was a anticlimactic ending of a season necessarily, because a lot of shows like Better Call Saul, for example, which we've mentioned many times, and Boardwalk Empire and Game of Thrones even and stuff, have the penultimate episode be the big wowzer episode and the final episode be a bit more slow paced, somber, and just kind of melancholic sometimes, or a little bit slower pace. So it's not
the season finale can be a reflection upon the season.
Yeah, and it can be like steaming, like the steam is being released from the previous episode, because that is the way modern television does. So it's not necessarily that that's the fault. My big thing at the time was, oh, the Klingon War's over? Oh, we barely did anything with it. I was completely bewildered at the fact, and that is still ringing true, but that is not my huge issue with this episode. It is a big one, but it was confusing to me the first time. I'm like, oh, we wrapped up the Klingon War? And the way we wrapped it up is very perplexing. But the fact that the war is finished within the one season is so befuddling, and I think...
Yeah, the war itself lasted roughly a year.
Roughly a year. And that isn't necessarily wrong, but it is just so weird because we spend so little time on the actual war, yet the show was about war, yet we barely spent any time on the war. So then at the end when it says, oh, that's the end, you get left with, well, what the hell's next season going to be about? Because I thought this was a show that was testing Star Trek's philosophies under wartime scenarios, like Deep Space Nine eventually became. And Deep Space Nine, spoiler alert, ended when the war ended. It didn't go on for two more seasons after the Dominion War and was like, here we go. No, it ended. The Dominion War wrapped up. They had some other loose plot threads that they had to wrap up, but other than that, it pretty much ended after the big war, because the exploration of what happens to the Starfleet principles when they are under the amount of pressure that war brings was explored. This season was telling us this is what the show's going to be about. All the press material, all the promos, all the interviews, all the episodes were telling us this. So at the end, when they go, well, the war's over now, you are left with, well, what's next season? And not necessarily in the way that they want you to be, ooh, what's next season? You're more going, oh, they've wrapped up all the promise that the show was offering. For what reason?
The purpose of the war is not just to do action sequences, but in fact to reinforce and reiterate the original vision of the show.
There was no nice things in this episode, was there, Rachel? I don't think we have any actual positives. Do you have any actual positives for this episode? Like, concrete, no caveats, no, oh, this little wrinkle of whatever, like, is there actually anything that was good?
No.
Not anything?
No.
I was thinking really hard about this, and there was nothing for me that is actually, like, concrete, this is good. There's little things that glimmer at the idea of good, but a reference isn't a mark for me. Like, oh, well, they got Clint Howard. Clint Howard's been in Star Trek several times before. He was in the original series. I'm not going to give it an extra point because it managed to get someone from the past. That's not an achievement that the episode is, like, that is just, oh, well, they cast someone, but that's not anything actually important to the story. Did his character have a character? Did he do anything of note? Was he there for any purpose other than, oh, look, we got Clint Howard. Remember him from previous Star Treks?
But he says, you were asleep.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And he's Orion, so he's sleazy.
That's his character.
He's sleazy. And that's fine, because we've had other episodes of Star Treks where they got previous actors from Star Treks to play different types of characters, ones like that. But the whole episode, you don't give it a tick because, oh, well, they got that actor again. Unless that actor really brings something to that role. Like Kurtwood Smith. He was in Star Trek VI, I believe, as the president of the Federation, and then he came back in Star Trek Voyager. You didn't give him an extra tick because they got the same actor again. You gave him a tick because he actually did something amazing in Star Trek Voyager. He was a memorable villain. He was someone you cared about. And it was nice that, oh, they gave him a chance to come back. Or David Warner has been in Star Trek many times. Each time he's come in, he gave something different, and so you give him, like, oh, I'm glad that they keep getting David Warner to come back, because he keeps giving us really brilliant performances, but Clint Howard, he was just here. Didn't give us a brilliant performance, didn't give us nothing, so that's not a tick. And the only other thing that I felt was positive-ish was I don't mind the idea of putting Ash Tyler as the bridge between the two worlds, an ambassador type figure to the Klingons and the humans, because he understands both sides. But I don't give that as a proper marking, because the next season doesn't go anywhere with it. They throw that away and make him a Section 31 Gestapo agent, basically. And the episode constantly tells us with literal lines of dialogue, he goes, I see it from both sides, literally. So that idea is undercut by the actual script, telling us that's the idea, not letting us pick up on what a neat idea that is. Because when you have the proposition of this character is a hybrid of these two races, and he's between both, like, he has a perspective on both societies that neither of them have. And that could be an interesting idea of putting that guy as an ambassador, or as someone who will work with both cultures and civilizations and races to finding a common middle ground, because he literally is an embodiment of that.
On the next Babylon 5.
Do not understand.
I understand that before me is a creature I do not recognize. 1 foot in two worlds. You are an affront to the purity of our race. And your belief that you are satisfying prophecy is presumption of the highest order. And yet, it is true that you are now the perfect liaison between us and the Earthers. You have no home with either of us. So please, act out your fantasy. Be our go-between. Return to Babylon 5.
There was nothing else other than, they completed character arcs. I didn't think they did them very well, because as we said throughout each episode thus far in the show, we have not been satisfied with how those arcs have been handled. But they completed them, and for Star Trek Discovery, that is literally a huge achievement that they will actually complete an arc. That's it.
But Ryan, we got sexy JoJo.
Oh, she's so good that the prostitutes need to learn some new tricks.
No, the prostitutes learned from her.
Oh, but they also need
they didn't
to learn.
She was so good. But with her corset and her panties still on.
Well, that's how good she is.
She doesn't need it.
Did you enjoy yourself?
Did you?
I learned so many new things. We shouldn't charge you.
But we have to charge you.
Perhaps if you teach me something new, it will be fair trade.
What about this episode, Rachel, made it not good? And would you say it was a truly bad episode? Or is this one of those ones where, in spite of the fact that we found nothing good in it, we can't truly say it is the a horrible episode?
Not sure where I land on it, because I did get really disheartened watching it. There are a few times where they were just shitting on things in a way. Like, that's the way that I felt about it, because they were bringing things up and doing things because it was a reference to previous Star Trek.
Or itself.
Or, like, trying to rework things, and it just made me really disappointed.
Yeah, I mean, very early on, just to give some behind the scenes, about 10 minutes in, you asked if we could pause the episode because you needed a break already. You were already taxed out from that aggressive Star Trek Discovery aesthetic, and not just visual aesthetic, but the aesthetic of its writing and performances that you have complained about very often on the show, as have I. Yes. And you needed a break 10 minutes in because it was very, very... I mean, I said 5 minutes in, I turned to you and said, what is happening? The acting is really, really terrible in this opener. Like, yeah. Beyond belief, terrible.
I just couldn't handle some of it. Like, I buried my face in my hands when Giorgio starts torturing Laurel.
Mm-hmm.
And it... because...
don't worry, at the end, they trust Laurel to be in charge of the giant military force that's against them.
It's okay that she's doing it, because the audience is in Michael's shoes and screaming that this is unacceptable and that they need to stop. But she waits until Laurel is severely injured before suggesting that there's another way.
That was the confronting thing about it, because we've seen captains and authority figures in Star Trek do horrendous acts, and our heroic characters are sidelined or standing by the sides or biding their time. And that was confronting for those episodes as well, but it was confronting in the different way of how, I guess, how you present violence on television has changed as well from the 60s, from the 80s and 90s, early 2000s to now. And that scene was grotesque. We understand why, because Giorgio's an evil Mirrorverse captain and Mirrorverse empress, and it's not out of character for her to do that, but
No. It
was confronting at the point where it goes beyond belief that Michael, our hero, the person that is our audience avatar, the person we are empathizing with, just sits there and has a dissatisfied look on her face, and then eventually just pipes in going, there's another way, you know. I was horrified, because I'm thinking, again, the show wants you to. They want you to be Michael. I go, I wouldn't do that, though. And if not me, I don't want my hero to stand there doing nothing. I want my heroes to actually take action. That's what we love about Kirk. That's what we love about Picard. That's what we love about Janeway and Sisko and Archer. Even that's what we loved about the previous Giorgio or Saru, even sometimes, is they won't just stand there. Sometimes they will get up and take action, whether they physically do or something. But Michael just stands there and lets her do it because the scene needs it.
But she screams at her to stop.
So but she doesn't do anything.
So that's enough, Ryan. That's enough. She yells, stop.
And
then Giorgio actually does. And then we don't get any follow-up about Laurel.
Oh, no.
Dealing with her wounds.
No.
Anybody from Medbay checking on her.
We don't need that. But the issue is, you don't follow up with Laurel until the end, when then they hand Laurel ultimate power. And the previous time you saw Laurel, she was literally getting tortured by Starfleet. If she didn't already have a boner against Starfleet beforehand, who have not tortured her physically, tortured her, and then they go, here, be in charge and also don't attack us.
I do just want to be clear that we are using the word torture on purpose, because
that's what it was.
Giorgio is attacking her to get information.
And for glee, because she's a racist, in case you didn't pick it up.
She's Karen.
It was very subtle. Again, not out of character for her, and it's not as if we haven't seen scenarios like this in Star Trek, but due to the language that modern television allows with showing us how violence is portrayed on screen, it makes it beyond uncomfortable for us. It makes it beyond belief that we should invest empathy in Michael Burnham in that scene. It makes us go, what the fuck are you doing, Michael? And you can't go beyond that for the episode, because in the rest of the episode, Michael is just bored. She looks malaised and she's kind of despondent. But I'm going, Michael, remember early in the episode when you watched someone get tortured in front of you? That would fucking haunt me or anger me or something. But no. Don't have time for it.
Well, you have to remember that Michael only really has three modes, which is like
crying. They don't count as three. That's just one. Michael's monologue at the very beginning is just laying on so thick for the audience what we are supposed to take away from the episode. Here's what the theme is. Here's what the message is. Here is what us, the writers, want you to get out of this episode. And of course, writers need to communicate these things to an audience, but there is a thing called subtlety. There is a thing called tact. Okay. And the opener had literally none of those.
I also just, I want to address that fable for something else as well. Because
this is a show about faith.
Yeah.
You know how Star Trek has always been about faith and not about cold deduction and logic and science trumping that kind of thing? And
yeah, it's not like there's an episode teamwork, of TNG where they
Who watches work. The watches? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whatever.
No.
I think one of the things that we are really interested this year is the collision of science and spirituality.
I've constantly throughout the season of Star Trek Discovery been saying, hey, look, the actors, I believe that they're all talented and they just get led astray by bad writing and bad direction. And I still stand by that. And I have nothing against the actress who plays Michael. I have only seen her in this show, so I cannot attest to how great she is outside of it. But this episode, that monologue, it is the first thing you hear, and I'm immediately taken out of it, because all I could hear was an actress on a Friday afternoon in a sound booth having to read this line for the 15th time. There is that thing of when you do, I'm doing a Vulcan inflection on these lines. It takes a talented actor and director to pair that, the pairing of the actor and director really need to be in harmony for that to come across really well. And that's what was great about Leonard Nimoy. And not to sound like we're gatekeeping, like, oh, only Leonard Nimoy could do it, but there was a cadence, there was a rhythm, and there was an emotional underpinning to his vocal performance where when he talked, I wasn't seeing through him as a performer. I was seeing a brilliant performance. Michael, you hear her? I just hear a performance. I don't see a character. I just see an actor.
We've discussed before that a good performance of a Vulcan isn't just a flat voice and an expressionless face.
No, it's far more than that.
That's not interesting to watch. It doesn't engage you to the show or to the character. And you should be connected and invested in these characters that you are spending time with. We, like, Michael is who we are following. And we both feel like the show should have done a better job at making us care about her.
Yeah.
But also, particularly in this episode, that they should have been doing a better job with Sarek as a Vulcan as well.
I was confronted by how poor the acting was, and that was really, really shocking, because look, the acting has not been very good throughout the show. There has been lots of bad acting, but everyone in the scene was off. Doug Jones, Michelle Yeoh, Michael, and even the, you know, the other members of the bridge, they were all off, and it was very, 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 very odd for a high-end, prestigious show. It's as if when you watch Game of Thrones, say, and it was just, could you imagine in Game of Thrones, like early on especially, you had a whole entire opener in which every single person in the scene was giving a bad performance? It would have felt weird, right? Mm-hmm. And we should expect high level of art at this period of time, because TV has become this. And Star Trek Discovery, with these metaphors and fables and aesthetics, thinks itself as that. So when you have acting like this, you see through all of it.
Where I'm from, there's a saying, scared Kelpian looks for tough Kelpian. Have you gotten tough since we served together on the St. John, Mr. Saru?
Affirmative, Captain. Very tough. So much so that many find me simply unpalatable.
I don't know about that.
Emperor Georgiou should have stayed in the Mirrorverse, and this episode was a warning sign, really, as to why that character does not really work outside of that setting. And at the end of the season, at the end of this episode, it's kind of giving that, it's giving
but
you an out,
Brian,
of, well, she's going to be gone. And
didn't
then
you feel so much tension when she was on the bridge and like making fun of Saru and being like tough Kelpian? And then when, oh no, Michael's trying to out her by seeing if she knows the name of Georgiou's hometown.
Yeah. And it shows you that. And there's no way not to sound offensive when I say this, but Michelle Yeoh, English is not her first language, obviously. And she, in this episode in particular, was struggling to get out certain phrases. It's kind of like Arnold Schwarzenegger when, in the Terminator movies, he eventually becomes the guy who gives all the sci-fi jargon talk, like the cellular level, and he can't do it, and we all make fun of him for that. And I'm not saying we make fun of her for that, but it was very confronting again, because a lot of her lines were ADR'd, because you could see her mouth moving in a way where she was struggling to roll certain words, and that isn't a fault on her, but it is a fault on the scripts. The stuff should play to her strengths and not to her weaknesses. And we've talked about that constantly throughout the show. And Star Trek, the original series, Star Trek, Next Gen, all those, the good ones, they did that with their actors too. And they just didn't do that for her in this episode. It made her look bad. And I feel bad for her.
I want to say that I don't think that that's necessarily because of a language thing. I think that is also because of an accent thing, because we know that in certain accents, particular tongue twisters are more difficult.
Well,
and
yeah.
I also think of Stephen Fry having difficulty in the Harry Potter audiobook saying, Harry pocketed it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, you're right. It's not just a language. When I said language thing, I guess I was generalizing it. You know, it's the accent thing. It is her thick accent does, it does put limitations into her performance. And it's not to be unfair to her, but the scripts should accommodate her. They make her look as a weak performer when you have to see that she's struggling, or you could not understand certain words, or they're ADRing over her later because clearly she was struggling on the day.
Mm-hmm.
It shows through whatever she's trying to do with this. And this character is an unlikable character.
Mm-hmm.
The person who's torturing someone and is instilling all these evil philosophies. She's a fun, over-the-top character, but by her nature, she's unlikable. And if I'm seeing through her performance, it makes it even more unlikable, and I don't want to watch it. And maybe next season we'll see that maybe they write better for her limitations. And they should do that with a lot of the other actors in the show, like Michael Burnham, her actress. There's some things she's better at and some things she's not. And I wish that they would play to their actor's strengths, like previous Star Trek does did, and just other shows do. When you watch Breaking Bad, they knew what Aaron Paul's strengths were, and they knew what his weaknesses were, and they played to that. They wrote for him as well as the character, and I feel they're not doing that.
But I also do want to circle back to an idea that I'm sure that we've brought up before, which is that it is really not uncommon for the first series of a new Star Trek to suck. And to take a while to find its feet. Like, that's not unusual.
No.
But we are particularly noticing the shortcomings of the script in catering for its actors and working with their abilities in order to elevate the show.
Yeah. Let's talk about the actual plot of the episode, because this episode does have one. It's a, you know, a little undercover mission, an away mission, in which they go to Kronos to commit genocide.
Okay, can I give a nitpick straight off? Like, I don't know why this bothered me.
That Kronos was green?
So much.
I always thought it was a reddish planet, but it's green?
Yeah, it's green. That wasn't the one that I was thinking of. There are a lot of nitpicks that I have with this episode. But the one that I was annoyed at myself that it bothered me so much is that we get this scene where Tilly is introduced to Georgiou as being the evil Georgiou.
It's because she has her hair down so that she can touch her hair.
Yeah.
That's the only reason her hair's down. It's never down in any other scenes.
Hair down and curly. And then we get the, like, we've got to go get stuff and we've got to go get ready. And then Tilly's hair is straight.
Well,
and it's just like, that would take so long.
Well, Rachel, you're thinking from our current generation while they're in the future. So, I mean, this is a world in which there's a beep boop lady, in the same world where Arium exists, where I guess this lady could only speak in beeps and boops, but Arium can speak English.
It's just so unnecessarily complicated for the continuity. Like, even if
they just wanted it,
just wanted it for the aesthetics, and it just frustrates me so much.
Welcome to Star Trek Discovery. It's here for the aesthetics. That's what it is. They want the aesthetics.
But I get frustrated because, like, part of Tilly's character is shown through her hair.
Yeah,
that's meant to be part of her performing her aspects of being a Starfleet cadet.
But again, who is Tilly? Because this episode they're making her context is for King's Tilly, where she was awkward and socially inept. But remember last episode when we were praising
high, so it's funny.
But earlier in the episode when she met Georgiou, she was acting like early season one version of her, and we've constantly said, who is she? Because they keep changing it for whatever the episode requires. And this episode, she's that again. And I was like, oh, I remember last episode when she gave Michael the big speech about, you know, stop judging people and be a good person and all that. And then this episode, she's like, I'm high. And she's doing like the awkward Nazi salute from the Mirrorverse. And
don't do that.
Don't do that. And she's fumbling over words and it's all weird. And I get it. That's what they set up with Tilly. But as we've said, consistency of character has not been as prevalent. But the plot, Rachel, we've got to talk about the plot. We're going to put a bomb in Kronos and explode the planet plot.
Well, what was... Okay, so that's what actually ends up happening. But I'm still a little fuzzy on the details. So they originally said that they were going to send a drone down into the planet.
Into and the that volcano systems.
Yeah, that only worked if the volcano systems weren't active, which they were.
Yes.
Which is when we discover that it's the bomb, right?
A bomb, yeah.
And I feel really dumb. But what was their actual plan? What was the fake plan in reality? Like, just to get the drone down there, but what were they going to do with the information with the drone? Was it just to go in and then go out and then get the information about the military bases that they were then going to attack?
Yeah, I think my basic understanding, and
like,
again,
that sounds like it's going to take a long time. And
no, they got future tech.
They got future tech. So it but can they've do got it in a second. They've got to survey an entire planet from the inside of the planet, and the Klingons are just waiting at the edge of our solar system to attack it.
It's called tension.
Okay.
And again, you're thinking, but you're thinking of it from the perspective that they wanted you to, which is, oh, well, that's a little weird. When the actual plan was they're going to put a bomb in there. That's why that doesn't matter.
No.
That has negated that questioning of that, because the Federation, Starfleet knew the whole time it was going to be a bomb. It was just the crew doing it didn't realize that, because they would not commit a genocide, as the episode concludes at the end. Maybe if Lorca was in charge still, they would have done it. I mean, remember Saru's great line? Force the creature to comply. I've never liked this plot. I've never liked it. It feels unbelievable that Sarek would propose this idea, because he got the idea. Like, he got told the idea from Georgiou, right? And then he went off and had a meeting on Vulcan and proposed that we should follow through with this idea. He was an instigator, if not the head guy, that proposed this to Starfleet. She was, you know, obviously came up with the idea, but he was the one who proposed it. And I don't believe for a singular second that Sarek, the great diplomat, the man who is the father of Spock and even Michael and all that, would see it logical, as well as peace. Like, I just don't buy that he would be up for committing planetary genocide. And that's where the episode falls apart, and the episode doesn't want you to focus on that. They don't want him in the episode until the very end, and then at the very end he has like a little throwaway line in which he admits he was wrong, and Michael was so brilliant because she figured out an alternative. And there is that thing of, well, logic can lead you astray, and wartime and all of that, that the episode does propose for put forward. But as we spoke previously on the show with Sarek, is the show wants us to remember that this is Sarek. This is the Sarek from TOS, the one who will be in TNG, the one in the movies. This is Spock's father. You have to remember that. And since I do, I know he wouldn't do that. So the episode's plot falls apart at the seams, especially on a rewatch, because all I'm thinking is, this plan wouldn't have gone ahead, and definitely not with Sarek being involved.
The Federation chose to do on Cronus was unprincipled, and I had a part in it.
I remember studying his career in school, the Treaty of Alpha Cygnus IX, the Corridon admission to the Federation, Klingon Alliance.
I met him once, many years ago, very briefly, at his son's wedding. I can tell you that was quite a moment for a young lieutenant, standing in the presence of such history. I remember he spoke to me, and I just stood there, grinning like an idiot.
Captain. You? Tongue-tied.
Indeed. How do you make small talk with someone who shaped the Federation?
There are lots of things that if you tug at the thread, it all falls apart. And there are things that I'm just like, wait, what? I don't understand. Like, I don't really get why Cronos, the Klingon homeworld, like, the part that we see of it is more populated by Ryans.
They did say a specific reason for it.
Yeah, but it's just, like, it doesn't... It feels weird.
I have an answer for you. Like, not
painting
the one...
Painting somebody as green is easier than prosthetics?
No. Because they have Klingons throughout the scene. No. Here's the reason. So they say the reason in the episode, which is blah. Oh, we had this old place, and we gave it out the Orions as an embassy, and we share businesses with them, right? Yeah. The actual answer, Rachel, is it would be too complicated from a writing perspective to have our characters, humans, on the home world, out in public, of the enemy. So, how about we... Oh, I don't know. Oh, how about if there's like an Orion colony on there? The Orions are neutral, to everyone. They don't pick fights with people in the way that the Klingons do. Like, if our crew transported down to Kronos during wartime, they would be killed on the spot. But luckily, there's an Orion section that just happens to line up with their plans, so that way they can just walk around and not get killed. There was an episode of Next Gen in which they had to infiltrate a bunch of Romulans, and they surgically altered themselves to look like Romulans, so that way they didn't get picked up. Why didn't Star Trek Discovery do that in this? Because the Klingons were so ludicrous that you would have to experiment on a human being turned into a Klingon far worse than what Ash Tyler had, which was a Klingon being turned into a human.
Yeah.
So we can't do that. So how about, as writers, we write ourselves out of the tricky situation by having a convenient Orion base camp where our characters can just walk around and not have to worry about being attacked or kidnapped or murdered or any of the things that would bring tensions to the idea of, hey, we're going to go onto the enemy's turf. We're going to go to the Klingon homeworld. When you get pitched, Rachel, that idea as an audience member, you would think, oh, there would have to be a lot of espionage and undercover work and secrecy, because you can't just have Klingons walking next to a human in war times or they would be killed on the spot. But yeah. This episode says, no. Forget that. That's fine.
No, we're moving on from that. But another nitpick that I would like to address is a scene where it's just like, oh, you had this cool idea and you were just like, okay, we'll move stuff around it. What do you think that I'm talking about?
No, I don't know.
I'm talking about the weird tattoos that, because Michael has wandered off because she
well,
can't...
it's safe enough for a small human female to wander off on her own on Kronos because there's an Orion emissary, you know, there's Orions there, so yeah. It's fine.
So she basically walks into a tattoo parlor and, like, the tattoos change and, like, show weird kind of lights.
Yeah.
When you touch them. So I'm like, okay, that's a cool idea. What I didn't, I was like, oh, what? Why is there a human woman that's completely unrelated to all of this? Just there getting a tattoo.
Oh, they said that they did have humans on there, but they were like delinquents.
Yeah.
So
like that's
there's an
part
explanation.
Of the cover, but yeah, it's like, oh, well, we really know she's a delinquent. She's getting a chest tattoo.
Before we delve into like the big core bad things that I think will bring up meaty discussion, I want to...
But Ash Tyler might as well be a dog on water skis.
Well, yeah, of course he has a boat, you know.
Yeah, that's his naval heritage is really important to him, Ryan.
Have a not.
We definitely knew about that before the establishing shot of his quarters that had all of this random boat paraphernalia.
Rachel,
and a random picture of a child fishing. Definitely.
He had a lake house. Remember the lake house scene in the Blue Planet episode in which they tried to establish that he had an important backstory? So they did set it up. It's just your fault for not remembering because you were not invested.
Yeah, I really should have thought, yes.
The lake house scene.
You know what is the first thing that makes Ash Tyler?
Naval.
Learning how to tie a slip knot.
He loves the band Slipknot. That's why he had to learn it. Okay. Before we hit the big beats, I think let's just kind of breeze through some of the things that were confounding or bizarre or just plain bad. The show does not get a tick from me because it says bread and circuses, which is a reference to a TOS episode. That's not a... It was actually quite weird that it was there, and I found it very silly and weird. This episode was...
But it would also make sense for Giorgio to idolize Julius Caesar.
I also found the episode was riddled with some bad lines. The peak line for me was you require seasoning when Laurel sees evil Giorgio and she's like, well, we ate you. Mm-hmm. And she's like, well, that wasn't me. And she's like, oh, well, whoever you are, you require seasoning. And I was perplexed by that. And I found it laughably bad. I was chuckling at how terrible it was, not at it being funny.
My turn?
Yeah.
Oh, Gabriel must have found something interesting lying around this universe.
Yeah, it was very weird because you would expect that the payoff there was, oh, his war room is filled with tech, right? And that's kind of what they do, but they play it so nonchalantly.
Like, it's like that's a bigger human payoff tech that they're showing off as far as we can see. Because they're like, yes, it's state of the art and it's like able to be hidden from things. And it's just like, if there was a line about like, well, yeah, you know, it makes a lot of sense now that, like, Lorca is getting us to develop secret weapons because we're a science ship, but no.
No, before you trail off, you know what would have fixed that scene? Some follow-through. They give, as their big thing that Lorca has in his war room, is the marbles, the antimatter marbles, because they made a point that it was very unique to have these.
Yep.
But, again, you would also not feel sympathy for our characters for giving a random Orion mass weapons of destruction. Yeah, they still gave them weapons, so...
Yeah.
There was no line like, oh, they're actually defunct or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, they gave these people active weapons. Slave traders, just remember that. They make a point to remind us that Orions are evil. And Clint Howe, oh, here's one.
Oh, but we get strippers.
They're Orion's strippers, so it's fine. Clint Howard was in the episode, and I noted down that in his second scene, when he appeared, he for some reason decided his character should have a slightly Asian-sounding accent that he didn't have in the first scene when he appeared. I don't know what the choice was there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why he decided halfway through that he should have a slightly Asian inflection in his vocal lines, but...
Yeah, it was must a be very because bizarre he choice. Got high too. So when
he was already smoking up before she got there.
Yeah,
but you noticed that, right? Am I crazy? I swear, he had a
no. It gets worse. Yeah, like it's kind of there in the first scene, but then when it cuts back, it feels like it's a lot more overt, and it's just like I feel like he didn't learn the right lesson from Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
It also showed us that Klingons have multiple penises.
Or at least multiple urethras.
There's nothing to say about that. That was that speaks for itself.
It just made me think that his penis is like a flute, where it's just got holes along all of the top.
The shorthand is it shows us that Klingons have multiple penises, at least. And
now I'm sticking with my flute penis idea.
Just remember, guys, Worf, when you watch Next Gen next time, just remember
he's packing multiple.
He's got multiple down there. I'm shocked that I didn't notice the outline of multiple in his little pajami whamis, but he has remember
or
Alex
in the Robin Hood outfit.
Oh, he's not a merry man. He's packing very many men. I wonder if his son Alexander has multiple, or is it because he's not fully Klingon, he doesn't? Because he came from a mother who was half Klingon, but I wonder.
Yeah, like, how dominant is the gene that gives you multiple
penises?
Thanks,
Star Trek Discovery, for bringing these questions into older generations of Star Trek. I'm loving that.
But you know what's important?
No, what?
It has to be even more Michael's fault that her parents died.
Well,
because it wasn't just because they were there or she made a noise. It was they weren't even meant to be on the planet, but she begged them to stay for an extra 3 days.
Okay, I really do want to talk about this scene. It comes in out of nowhere. Not actually, it has a purpose, but for us, we want them to realize what's happening and push forward, but we're getting the, here's my character story.
I never told you this, but I'm going to open up and be very emotionally wrong with you because we're in this tense situation.
why did they not tell us this fully earlier? Because they told us in ways that her parents were killed by Klingons, and I was satisfied with that. But this story makes it so that it feels as if this was the big thing that they've been hiding from us about her character the whole season. But we already knew that her parents got killed by Klingons. We didn't know the full details. I don't know. It just feels very off that they wait to the final episode. And maybe it's because we aren't invested in the romance that's happening in the scene. Because this is a romance story. This is a telenovela. This is one of those old books that your grandmother has with the guy with his shirt off and he's on a pile of hay. You know, like, this is one of those. This is one of fucking those. And it's like, oh, Scarlet, I know that I'm a Native American and my people scalped your father, but I still love you. Can you see past my race? And she's like, oh, Chakotay. Yes, I can. Like, that's how it feels. It is as ludicrous as that.
To me, it, like, obviously because this is our first rewatch and we've seen season two, it feels like they got to the point where they were like, oh, we really want to have a flashback. So we need to add a little bit more detail. Okay, we're going to add this extra line here.
We set up very clearly that she knows both of her parents were brutally murdered, but actually her mum got away and you didn't know that. And it's weird that the... Whatever. It doesn't line up.
She heard everything, but she couldn't see.
She specifically told us in detail how she heard that her father got killed, then her mother.
Yeah.
But season two, we'll talk about that when that comes up, because that's a whole different thing. The issue is, as I keep saying, the issue is, many issues. The big prevailing one throughout the thing is, I do not care about Michael Burnham, and scenes that demand that I care about Michael Burnham, let alone care about Ash Tyler, fall completely flat on their face because the show has not warmed me to their characters. I care about characters like Saru and Tilly and even Paul. Even if their stuff has been inconsistent as well, I find their problems, their woes, their perspectives, and their drives far more entertaining. Not just relatable, but entertaining.
And if we give the Federation targets to attack, it won't ever be the same.
I can see both sides. Literally. The side I've chosen is where you stand, where it's possible to feel compassion and sympathy for your enemy.
I want to talk about Star Wars.
I may have gone too far in a few places.
When I was a kid, I never liked Star Trek when I was a kid.
I told Ryan, I fundamentally disagree with virtually everything you've decided about my character.
The Disney overlords were not ready to do that.
At this time, I see no difference between how Star Wars is handled currently and Star Trek. And in this episode, they have the moment in which Giorgio is trying to tempt Michael to commit planetary genocide. And it is very reminiscent of something you'd get from Star Wars, the join me and we shall have ultimate power. And it felt like Star Wars. And the reason for the Star Wars nature that I feel from this show is obviously that the Star Trek 2009 was written by and created by and has influenced the next generations of Star Trek, such as Discovery, by people who love Star Wars. And I don't hate Star Wars, but you know what I love about Star Wars? It isn't Star Trek. And you know what I love about Star Trek? It isn't Star Wars. That's one of the things. And we just recently rewatched Last Jedi and, you know, we saw the Rise of Skywalker and we've seen these new sequel trilogies and I see no difference, really, between the two anymore. You could write into Discovery that they transport into a far distant galaxy and it's Star Wars and I would believe you. It is so similar. And in this episode, they had the scene. It was the Darth Vader scene where it's like, join me, we can rule it all together, my son. And it's the same dynamic of a parental figure demanding in an abusive, toxic way for their child to join them in being a Nazi. I kind of hate Star Wars now because of shit like this in which Star Trek had a unique sci-fi identity, as did Star Wars. And now that identity has homogenized and they've become one. And both of them have lost that unique spark that made them special in their identity. And this episode kind of showed me that. This could have been an episode of The Mandalorian or some other Star Wars show.
Yeah. The overall feel of the season wasn't steered away from that when we see the Terran Empire. And essentially they do, like, the First Order versus the Rebels.
But I just wanted to point that out because I notice it, and I feel like sometimes I'm the only one who notices it, and it only bugs me. But I think more and more people are kind of noticing that the two are bleeding closer and closer together, and it is disheartening to both properties. What about the show, the season overall, Rachel? What about it has made Laurel such a lackluster character?
I think a part of it is, for me, that she really is defined by other people and those around her. She's hardly ever got any genuine agency. Like, even when she's the captain of her own ship, she doesn't actually have that much agency because she was forced into that situation and she's beholden to all of these other people. And in many ways, she's dominated by all of these other relationships.
But you could argue that she is reacting to those and becoming a mastermind character, where she's made Vok into the secret agent and she's the one who made that happen and she's the one who got the Admiral out of the jam, and she's essential to a lot of aspects, but all those are there, but
she still feels like a pawn to me. It doesn't feel like it feels like everything she does is a response. But the visual language and the way that the show tries to present her is that she's a big, badass Klingon lady. She won't tell you nothing, but she knows it all.
She'll tell you when it's convenient for the plot.
Yeah, if you manipulate her hard enough and basically mentally manipulate her into it. By abusing her emotional connection to
Kuzmov and Vok and her home planet. I think there was an interesting idea with Laurel that
you just press the right buttons and it gets Laurel to do the thing.
I think underneath all of the issues with Laurel, screen time being a major one, us fully understanding where she stands, like, is she someone we're supposed to care for? Or are we supposed to be against her? Because we talked about this with Vok and how with the Ash Tyler Vok thing, there's supposed to be a tragedy there because we're supposed to feel sorry for not only Ash but Vok as well, but we don't. Because he was a weird fanatic who was on the side of the bad guys. And Laurel is a weird fanatic who's on the side of the bad guys. And at the end of the season, she's still heralding to Kuvmov's beliefs. And we understand that to be wrong. But at the end, we're supposed to be happy that she's in charge, and that means we are supposed to have cared about her. And again, we've already talked about it too, they also framed her at one point as a rapist, which I'm not going to get into that again, but why?
But she's a zealot we can trust.
She's a zealot we can trust, but that's not how they play it either. It's not one of those, well, we put someone in that we can trust for now.
No, but I'm saying that's how we see.
But it would have worked if it was one of those, unfortunately, we've put in a mad dog, but that's under our control for now. But they're going to be a problem later. But it does feel like, oh, we solved the solution. We got a good Klingon on charge. Great. Just, Laurel, why? Like, what are we supposed to feel about her? Like, are we supposed to be against her or for her? Because I feel like multiple times we're supposed to be in both ways, but not in the way that is successful, where you feel like you're with someone and against someone constantly, a tug of war throughout a show. But I don't feel like they successfully did that. But underneath all of it, I think there was an interesting thing with Laurel that they could have done, which was at the end, she has seen firsthand the issues that Starfleet have with the Klingons, that she has witnessed and experienced this chaos that is the Klingons. And she understands that Takuvmov's belief system was flawed and wrong, and that she needs to change it herself. Thus, she becomes the leader. But at the end, she just sees that Takuvmov was right, but the fight itself has made us crazy. So let's just band together. And she still doesn't see the flaw, or at least it doesn't communicate effectively enough that she has seen the flaw that was Takuvmov, that Takuvmov was a crazy bigot and nothing more. At the end, it feels like, oh, she still believes that he was right and she's going to champion his beliefs. But at the end of the day, his beliefs were one of a bigot.
Yeah, it would have been something different if it's framed or explained that she's learnt what the Federation is actually about, because that was like a part of it, particularly in those first couple of episodes that they kept on harping on about, was the lie of we come in peace.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
If it's just like, well, Laurel either learned that that really was the truth and that the Klingons should be on the side of the Federation and becoming at least an ally to the Federation in some way, like that stepping stone
and they
towards
think
those experiences that we see in previous Star Trek, so Klingons being involved and present in the Federation.
And well, and the thing is, there are the things you can point to that they have showed us in the actual episodes that point to that actually having happened. But that is also when you have to disregard the things that will counteract that. As in, like we said, this episode, she gets brutally tortured by a human on the authority of Starfleet. And they never resolve that issue. She just at the end is given supreme leadership of the giant military force that was about to fuck Earth in the ass. Why would she not continue to do that? They gave her the bomb, so they have no hold over her now. If it was me, again, if I was just brutally tortured by the so-called, you know, peaceful-loving Federation, and I still believed in Takuvmov, why would I stop? Because
I would at least want to beat the shit out of the person who beat the shit out of me if I could. And we are told that she is fully capable to do that. So, but she's like, nah, I gotta take care of the Klingon business.
It's confusing and bewildering. That's this episode, confusing and bewildering. It's
but I've been waiting to say this line.
Yeah.
So the Admiral says, we do not have the luxury of principles. And
yes.
Then Michael exults.
That's all we have.
And then we get a beautiful I am Spartacus moment.
We are Starfleet. We are Starfleet. It's very reminiscent of Janeway, right? Where Janeway would wave about, well, we can't get rid of our principles, even if we're in the Delta Quadrant. We can't be like you, the Equinox. Because without our principles, we have no humanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Great. And that's Michael's arc. And that is, we'll talk about that in a sec. But just to finish up with Laurel, at the very beginning of the show,
but
we said that
I bought that up because we are told over and over again that the only thing that getting Laurel through is her principles.
Mm-hmm.
And we see no evidence that her principles have changed. It's just that finally she's been rewarded for being a true believer.
No. Her principles were changed because her and the Admiral got on and she recognized that the Admiral was tougher than... She said at one point, Takuvmov was wrong about you humans or whatever. So that's how they think that they've done it. But that is if you disregard all the other aspects, the torturing, them forcing her to turn her lover back into a human, all of these things. If you remove all the things that would trigger someone into being a villain, if you disregard them, then sure, her arc was completed and successful and it makes sense. But that is if you erase literal storyline aspects of the show as well. And am I supposed to do that? I don't think so.
To know that she started as just a lower bridge deck commander, you know, there's just a look between her and Takuvma.
Yeah.
And to get to a place where she steps out of the shadows, it was really invigorating for the writers to watch that happen.
You know, we'll give in Sarek some slack in that Lethe episode for being too emotional and not like Sarek. And, you know, some people may push back against that. I'm sure they have. And you could say, though, that he's very much like Sarek. But this episode, not only one have I already gone through the fact that he was totally down to commit a global genocide, which, no, that's not Sarek. I'm sorry. Him, in this episode, he's a human. That's not Vulcan. That's not a fucking Vulcan. He's human. I'm seeing a human smiling and laughing and filled with love in his heart, openly with emotions.
He shows just as much emotion as his wife does in that scene that they share.
And I know, and we know that Vulcans do have emotions. They're just, you know, suppressed under all their training and stuff. But the acting, he's just playing it like he's not a Vulcan. And I'm sorry. It just undercuts everything in the scene because this is a show called Star Trek. And you have a guy who's not acting like a Vulcan, yet you got the fucking ears on him. And he's supposed to be the, one of the most Vulcan Vulcans who has ever existed in Star Trek. I remember when we first watched it, I made jokes about the ending monologue being really contrived and contrite and silly, and I would walk around for weeks after, like I did with Yum Yum, where after Yum Yum happened, I would make Yum Yum a thing, where you'd talk and I would just be like, yes, that is us, out of nowhere.
This is Star Trek.
Yes.
This is Starfleet.
This is Starfleet. Yes, that is who we are, when you would say something. And I forgot that that happened, and then when the episode happened, it re-triggered my brain of when that was like a thing in my life that I would adopt, because it was so silly.
I felt weirdly kind of exalted and proud of myself, because when it got to that scene, I was just like, I'm sure I'm imagining how jarring it is when they're splicing together her speech and the medal ceremony. But no, I found it just as jarring and just as bad this time.
It felt like a YouTube edit.
It
felt like a YouTube edit of, you know how people edit those scenes from Star Wars and Star Trek to make them kind of awkward?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was, but in an actual episode.
Oh, the weird slide transition with the billboard.
Oh, my God.
When she's outside with Sarek, like, I was in complete dissonance as to what was going on. And I also just want to bring up while we were discussing this part of the episode is that I am so frustrated that they just say, and we've all agreed to expunge your record.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
the
yeah.
thing that defined her, they told us over and over and over and over and over and over and over again that she's Starfleet's mutineer, the mutineer. Oh, her mutineer side. And now that's just gone.
She was so famous that even random convicts knew who she was. That's how famous she was of a mutineer. It wasn't as if it was a secret thing, but
it's just gone.
The episode ends with these monologues, these speeches telling us, I've had a character arc, like, Admiral, you don't want me to perform another mutiny against you because, see, a year ago, I was in the same space as you where I chose, you know, principles. I chose my, you know, I sacrificed principles over logic and over trying to win a scenario and all this, and I've now had an arc and I now realize that is wrong. Great.
Principles.
That's great.
Are what saves us.
And that is great stuff. And especially for a season-long arc of having a character who started out throwing their principles away and then at the end enforcing, no, we need those. That is actually very good. And I actually didn't mind how that scene played out necessarily until we got the We Are Starfleet and they all do their stand-up and We Are Spartacus. I thought Michael's speech, as overwrought as it already is, was enough. But as always, it's never enough. Is it?
You don't get it yet.
You don't get it yet.
You don't get it yet.
It's not just about, you know, we're Starfleet. Oh, look, it's that character, the black guy on the bridge. You don't know. He stood up. So you feel empowered now, right? I don't know him, though.
Yeah, he's had lines before and he got yelled at earlier in the episode.
He was called by Harry Mudd, random communication man.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that because it kind of comments that even the show knows they don't know what these characters are in the background. am annoyed that the show says with monologues, here's all the effort we put in with the character arcs and the character development, and here we are celebrating how good we done it, and pat on her back, and Michael gives a speech about how we...
But Tilly's an ensign now, so everything is better.
And she's in the command program, and...
She got what she wanted.
And Paul's holding...
We know how much that means to her.
And Hugh's medal's there, and Paul's there, and Saru's getting a Medal of Honor for the first time for a Kelpian. That's great. That stuff's cool and whatever. But what I get annoyed is they have a giant monologue where Michael, you know, the no, we this, no this, and then yes, in which the monologue's telling us what we were complaining about last episode, which is how come the show hasn't had reflection on the fact that our crew of characters were morally compromised because of one man. Because of Lorca, as well as because of war. They don't have a moment where they reflect upon that. This is the reflection. The monologue that said, oh, we learned our lesson. But I don't really feel like they really came to terms with it. But this is it, and we're never going to touch this again. Lorca was a weird detour that we're never going to mention again. He was nothing. It was just a detour. A little experiment in the narrative, and we're moving beyond it. And it really does feel like that was a waste of time.
This is what matters now.
No!
This is what matters now.
No, no, no.
But the show's not over. Because we have to jam in the USS Enterprise at the very end. And I remember so hard where I was, what was my attitude when I saw that they were doing that. And...
When you only needed to
see the NCC.
I
didn't even need that. As soon as I said they were getting a distress call, I'm like, oh no, it's going to be the fucking Enterprise, isn't it? Isn't it? And it is. And it sent a cold shiver down my spine, and not in the way of, oh yay, the Enterprise, as in, oh no, this is what it's going to be.
It's like, don't bring my baby into this. Don't leave the Enterprise.
It's not that.
Out of that.
It's not even that of, no, I want to gatekeep and be like, no, don't ruin the canon. It's, I just want this show to stand on its own fucking merits. I want it to stand on its own fucking merits. I want it to be its own thing. I don't want it to ride off the coattails
stand
of Star Trek.
By something. Mean something.
Be your
Do
own thing.
Something that's more than insulting my intelligence.
Be your show. Even if I don't like it, have the balls and the commitment to actually stand on your own merits and not piggyback off of the merits of previous Star Trek shows, which the show disregards many times. Like we said, the messaging and themes and continuity and all that. And if you're a fan of the show, and we don't truly hate the show, but if you're a fan of the show and you go, hey guys, that stuff doesn't matter, we have constantly said, hey, we've let these things go. But as soon as the show attaches itself to those previous Star Treks, it's not unfair to reference the fact that Star Trek Discovery has distanced itself from those previous Star Treks. So then when it does join it and bring it to its own show, it's dissonant. You go, wait, what? And
yeah.
At least for someone like us, where we notice these things, we're not sucked into the, oh, I can't wait to see their version of Spock and Pike.
No, like, we're always going to be prefacing and trying to make sure that we keep this in mind, that this is just our opinions and we're discussing these things not because we want to shit all over it or because we think if you like this, you're bad. It's just because these things impact, alter, and lesser the way that we engage with this story and how much we enjoy it.
Because there are so many great ideas and so many great characters and stuff struggling underneath so many of the decisions. The decision to make it a prequel, the decision to bring in, if you're going to make it a prequel and you're going to disregard Star Trek, then don't regard Star Trek as well. And we've talked about it all, but when that Enterprise showed up, I just wanted to die because I knew that the show would be, now it's time to suck the dick of the original series whilst also not knowing what the original series was about or what the original series is saying or doing. because Star Trek Discovery has set up its own tone, its own universe, its own style that aren't like, that isn't like the original series. And as soon as that Enterprise showed up, I just went, oh, all these ideas, all these things that I reckon they could fix up in between the seasons is going to be flushed down the toilet because we're going to just be riding the dick of Star Trek whilst also not understanding it. And, well, we'll talk about that next season, won't we? But it did not fill me with joy. It filled me with dread, as did when they said Michael was the sister of Spock, because I just want the show to be its own thing. When Next Gen, when Voyager, when DS9 tributed and elements and sucked the dick of previous Star Trek, when they had Bones on, when they had Scotty on, when they had Sulu on, when they did that stuff, it was for one episode, and it was a neat little nudge, and those shows were more tonally in line with the original series. But this show already had Harry Mudd, this show already had all these things, but I don't know. I could go on for ages about it, but the ending of it did not fill me with the satisfaction of, I want to see more.
How did the idea to put the Enterprise in there come about?
So the whole season was reverse engineered from knowing really at the beginning where we wanted to end.
Yeah.
And from Sinequa's arc and for the bridge crew coming together as a family and knowing that the Enterprise was going to show up as the last frame, because obviously we owe the audience some answers to the question of why has Spock never mentioned his half-sister before?
Uh-huh.
So, obviously, there's the Enterprise promises answers to that question.
Sometimes you think of a great scene. Oh, we really want to have a head on a turtle and then have it blow up or whatever. That's well and good, but if you have to drive square pegs into round holes in order to get to that great scene, then you're doing it wrong.
So the whole season was reverse engineered from knowing really at the beginning where we wanted to end.
Would you give this episode... Oh, wait, before we do that, jeez.
Huda.
It's time for the Huda. They didn't reference him outside of he got a medal too. For what purpose?
Well, I think the idea was basically everybody on the crew got a medal.
I didn't see the black lady doctor get a medal, the one who replaced Paul.
No, she wasn't important enough. So only the original kind of bridge crew.
He wasn't a part of the bridge crew?
Yeah. All part of Stamets' department, because is it only Stamets and Tilly that get a medal for the spore drive?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They were the only ones that worked on it. So,
yeah, we don't know any other names, so they don't matter.
Detmer? Oh, wait. Did Arium get a medal? I don't think I saw her there.
I didn't see her in the lineup.
And remember, she's the highest ranked bridge crew after the first officer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, after they put her in charge. Yeah. How come she didn't get it? Maybe she did. Either way, this is the Huda, the part of the show where we talk about the great character of Dr. Hugh Colbert and what he contributed to the episode. He is literally dead at this point. He contributes nothing. They do not mention him outside of the fact that he got a medal too. Why did he get a medal when, one, the show makes a big point that he is not the chief medical officer. So why did he get a medal? If they're giving it to all the big players, right? The chief medical officer who we've never met and is never in the show, right? But why did this random doctor who died... Is it because he died? He gets a medal because he died? Maybe that's it. But Hugh gets a medal because he's a character in the show. And as we've detailed, he really never got much to do as a character. But it's nice because Paul's holding his medal and he looks very somber about it. And he looks like, oh, Hugh got a medal too. Well, that's cute. You know what the medal should have said on it?
What?
You tried. Because Hugh died like an idiot. Like, let's not forget that Hugh died like a fucking idiot. And not because of the actor, not because of this. The script wrote him to be dumb. Let's not forget, he died because he knew that he was a secret Klingon. And so he decided to tell the secret Klingon he's a secret Klingon in a room alone without briefing anyone else about it.
No.
But he gets a medal because he was a good doctor. He was a brilliant doctor. And
he
as we've
really
detailed
knew.
Throughout the show, he wasn't.
He's a great doctor. He's a great doctor. He loves what he does. It's wartime. You know, it's pretty important to keep people alive. Sometimes I fail. There's only so much I can do, even in the future.
Would you give this episode a yum or a yum yum? Yum being bad, yum yum being good.
Yum.
I give it a yum. So, Next week, we will be doing the sum up of it all of season one, the faults, and hey, even the things that worked, because I don't know. There were things that did work and there were things that weren't, but we'll talk about that next week. Until then, you can find us on those social medias of Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, as well as even Reddit. Just look up Yum Yum Pod or Yum Yum Podcast on any of those and you shall find us. We're always posting some questions, some funny posts, discussions of things that we've talked about in the episode a bit further, and just general engagement. So hit us up on those, like us on those, follow us on those, share us around. Of course, rate, review us on all the podcatchers available to do so. It is very much appreciated. Your support means a lot to us. We have an email, don't we, Rachel?
Yes, yumyumpod@gmail.com.
In which you can email us your thoughts, your questions, your queries, your concerns, and your threats even. Or love letters. Or erotica, I don't know, just any erotica, to us. We also have a Patreon in which we have extra shows on there. We're talking about the movies, the Star Trek movies. We're talking about the best episodes and the worst episodes of other Star Treks. And we even give our thoughts on some other television shows. We've talked about
That aren't Star Trek.
We've talked about Sherlock.
That aren't sci-fi related even.
We talked about Sherlock. We talked about Doctor Who. And so on and so forth. So hit us up on there. That is Patreon and Yum Yum Podcast. It's all in the description. All the stuff there is in the description. Rachel.
Hey, Ryan.
Hey, Rachel.
Thank you for being Yum Yum.
Oh, well. I had to keep it in my pants all episode, the Yum Yum, but I'm just ready to let it out now.
All three?
All three. Yum Yum Yum!